This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Here's another trial that we've been waiting roughly 30 years for. Dwayne Keefe D. Davis is going to trial in Las Vegas for the 1996, 30 years ago, murder of Tupac Shakur, nearly 30 years after the shooting. He wasn't caught by forensics or witnesses who flipped. He was caught, prosecutors allege, because he couldn't stop talking about it. Defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis is with us to help break down what to expect as the trial for the murder of Tupac actually begins. Keefe D, he wasn't caught by DNA. He wasn't caught by detective work. He allegedly got himself arrested by writing a book. His 2019 memoir, Compton Street Legend, describes being in the white Cadillac, providing the gun and ordering the retaliation hit on Tupac after Tupac's crew beat Davis's nephew at the MGM Grand. He said the same things in a BET documentary. He said the same things in police interviews. Las Vegas Homicide says those public statements were what brought the investigation back to life after sitting cold for decades. Did this man talk himself into the murder charge, Eric?
Yeah, I think absolutely. He's been popping off for years and years and bragging about, oh, being involved in killing the, you know, a beloved artist in so many people's hearts. And so, yeah, that is, he has himself to blame. If he's sitting in that jail cell and wondering, why am I here? It is because he could not keep his mouth shut.
The reason Keefe D. Davis says that he talked, the only reason he told police anything was because he was promised immunity in 2008. It's called a proffer agreement. And remember that term, a proffer deal is where he cooperated with the LAPD on the Biggie Smalls investigation and gave up what he allegedly knew about Tupac's murder in exchange for protection from prosecution. So they were looking for information in the Biggie case. And he said, I can tell you things, but I don't want to be prosecuted for anything I'm about to tell you, but it could help you. He alleges they had that sort of proffer agreement there that said, okay, you're immune from anything that you tell us. Okay, so he talks. His attorneys fought to suppress those statements. The judge let them in. Let's talk about what that first means, Eric, a proffer agreement. Is it a black and white sign here? You're never going to be prosecuted. Is it a gentleman's agreement? What exactly is he talking about?
The term gentleman might be a little generous in some of the scenarios I've been in. But, you know, it can often be very informal. It's kind of like, the law enforcement's like, hey, dude, you're screwed on this and we're going to make it really bad for you. But if you tell us some good stuff that we can use, we'll make it less bad for you. And the person's like, less bad? What does that mean? Like, what are the parameters of this? And so sometimes if I ever have a client do this, I have at least some pillars of the agreement in writing agreed to by both sides, because this is the problem that arises is later on, KPD's like, I thought you said I wouldn't get in trouble for saying this stuff. And then they're like, well, we didn't talk about you saying this stuff outside of this context. And it's all a big confusing mess. And so sometimes it's unclear.
Is it almost, I mean, is it relied on sometimes by law enforcement to essentially set someone up and get them to speak more readily by omission of not informing them that, okay, within the context of this conversation, we can't go after you. But if you go on camera, if you go on BET, if you go on Vlad's podcast, if you go on whatever and talk about all of this shit, if you write a book about it, that we can go after you for, even if it's the exact same things you've told us, simply by omitting the fact that you can't go out there and talk about that, we're going to get you for it. But is that even the agreement with every proffer agreement? It seems like a very gray area agreement. That sometimes criminals put a little bit too much faith in of what they can talk about and what they can't talk about, and they don't really seem to understand that there's not really anything set in stone here to begin with.
I am so reluctant every time that this possibility comes up to advise a client to do a proffer for these very reasons that we're talking about, because you just don't know you can't foresee all of the possible contingencies down the road that could come up. And certainly the prosecution has no incentive to say, hey, but we won't prosecute you for X, but if you do Y or Z or A, B, C, D, E, F, then yeah, we will. They're not going to lay all that out. It's not in their interest to do that. And so, yeah, it just becomes very messy. And I think people should be very reluctant about doing it and about the information that comes from it at times.
The prosecution, they're not arguing that Keefe D pulled the trigger on this 30-year crime now. They say his nephew, Orlando Anderson, is the one who did it, fired the shots from the backseat of that white Cadillac, retaliation for the casino beatdown hours earlier that we all probably have seen the video clip of around the fountain. Anderson denied involvement before he died. He was killed in an unrelated Compton shooting in 1998, so 28 years ago he's been gone. So he can't testify. He can't be cross-examined. The gun has never been recovered. The prosecution's entire theory is that Davis was the shot caller, baller, 20-inch play, Zona Impala. The one who gave the order and supplied the weapon, basically. The alleged shooter dead. So how do you prove the order? And how do you prove he made the order when most of the witnesses are dead and this was 30 years ago? There's no digital trail, just the gangsta brags of Keefe D out there in social media and wherever he decided to talk.
As a general rule, if you're going to, as the prosecutor, have statements against a defendant, like he was the orchestrator and he did this and he did that, you've got to have the declarants of those statements come into court and say it. And if they are 6 feet underground, that's not happening. So you don't have that evidence, but most likely. And so you've got to have this gamed out in terms of how you're going to get from A to B to C and bring this jury along to have them reach that ultimate conclusion. And if you just have some guy who likes popping off to BET, that might not be enough.
Is it enough, though? I mean, at the end of the day, you go to a jury, you present all this stuff, and I know he's going to try and argue it and fight it, but you got that interview, this interview, that other interview, the book, him constantly saying and bragging about doing this. Why should a jury, for any reason? I mean, this seems like it could be somewhat of a slam dunk because you actually have the defendant saying he did it over and over and over and over. And now suddenly, oops, nope, I thought I was only talking like this for this reason. And now it's not. I mean, how do you think a jury's going to react to that?
I think alleged confessions are some of the most compelling evidence of guilt that we have in a trial. You got to start with that premise that this is going to move a jury. They're going to say, hey, he admitted to this, and not once, not twice, but a bunch of times. And so in jury selection, from the defense perspective, you have to kind of prime this jury to say, hey, I know we all think that, like, when a person, we hear that a person may have confessed to something, that must be it, right? Well, have you thought about this? Have you thought about false confessions? Have you thought about ulterior motives? Have you thought about why a person might say they did something that they didn't do, and hope you get a jury receptive to that if you're on the defense side?
Just basically, yes, he said it, but he said it for profit. He did it to self-enrich himself, and you can say he's a shitty person for making up stories that weren't his to make money off of, but at the end of the day, he's not a killer, even though, and you don't have, and their backup to that is a lot of people who could place him where he claims he was are dead. So, yeah, there's a lot of question there. Keefe D placed himself in the Cadillac in his 2008 police proffer. He placed himself in the Cadillac in his BET documentary. He placed himself in the Cadillac in his own memoir and described providing the gun and ordering the hit. Then after his arrest in 2023, he told ABC News he's innocent. I ain't killed nobody, he said. He said he only talked about the murder to make money. He even claimed at one point he wasn't even in Vegas when the shooting happened, contradicting his own book, his own documentary, and his own statements to police. I made it all up for money. Does that work as a defense, or didn't, or he didn't make a dime off the proffer, or did he think that the proffer was the ticket to money? Because of that, he could then talk after all of this went down.
You know, but put a different way, is there reasonable doubt as to the reliability of his confessions? Is there an alternative, plausible explanation as to why he would do this, that he wanted money, wanted notoriety, that kind of thing? Maybe. And then, you know, one thing you look at, too, is whether his confessions can be objectively corroborated or refuted by other evidence. You know, is there photographic evidence, video evidence, travel plans, receipts, bank statements, things like that, that could place him in certain places or not? And if we're talking about something that happened 30 years ago, there might not be a ton of corroboration. And so how reliable is that confession?
At the end of the day, on this one, I mean, he started talking in 2008 in that proffer agreement, and then he started talking after that in all the places we just talked about. Why did it take all of these years to make an arrest? What's your thought process there? Why now? Why wait all this time to finally go after Keefe D? I mean, why? Oh, well, you finally, the BET documentary, that wasn't enough. The interview over here, that wasn't enough. The book, that wasn't enough. I mean, like, what made the DA finally go, you know what, maybe we should go after this guy because he keeps talking about this?
It's a really good question, and I'm not sure I have a great answer. Why now? Why?
Yeah.
Why under these circumstances? And I think those are questions the defense needs to ask the jury rhetorically in closing argument. That, you know, if they really had the goods, you know, things haven't changed significantly in the past 5 years. They could have brought this 5 years ago or longer than that ago. They didn't. They're doing it now for some other reason. And if defense can give a compelling alternative reason why the prosecution might do that, that just further contributes to reasonable doubt, possibly.
I don't know the answer to that question either. I do wonder, and I don't know what the situation is. I haven't dug into this, but obviously we do see a lot of situations where we go, why are they prosecuting this right now? And you go, oh, someone's up for election and they want to have that in their little commercial. Like, I'm the one who put so-and-so away for the murder of so-and-so. I can't say that's what's going on. But we do see it quite a bit. I just don't know the answer to that question. Anyway, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We will follow this trial as it gets underway 30 years late. All right. Until next time. For Eric, for Todd and Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Nevada is trying a murder case with no murder weapon. The gun that killed Tupac Shakur on September 7th. 1996, 30 years ago now, God, I know I feel old, has never been recovered. No DNA connects Dwayne Keefe D. Davis to the shooting. The man prosecutors say fired the shots was Orlando Anderson. He denied it. He was killed in Compton in 1998 and will obviously never take the stand. He's been dead longer than he was alive. What the state has is a book Davis wrote himself. Judge Carly Kearney ruled it admissible, which means the jury gets to hear it. Las Vegas police had Davis's statements in hand for 14 years before anyone actually arrested him. Davis is now 63 years old. He faces one count of murder with a deadly weapon with intent to promote, further, or assist a criminal gang. The last part is a gang enhancement, which means extra prison time because prosecutors say the crime was committed for a gang. He has pled not guilty. He's been in custody since his arrest on September 29th of 2023 in Henderson, Nevada. The trial is expected to run about a month. If the jury convicts him, he faces life without parole. Tupac Shakur, 25 years old. In 1996, he's also now been dead longer than he was alive. He'd put out four albums and acted in five films. He was still writing. He was on his way to be one of the biggest stars in hip hop ever at that moment in time. And if you don't know, you don't know because you weren't there. Back in 1996, the world of hip hop, the world of all of that was very different than it is today. And on the night of September 7th, 1996, he was in the passenger seat of a black BMW. Marion Suge Knight, the founder of Death Row Records, was driving. They just left the MGM Grand after the Mike Tyson and Bruce Seldon fight. Earlier that evening, surveillance cameras inside the casino at the MGM recorded Tupac and Knight and their entourage beating a man near a bank of elevators in a fountain. It lasted about 2 minutes before security broke it up. That man was Orlando Anderson. It was Davis's nephew and a member of the Southside Compton Crips. Tupac and Knight ran with the mob crew Bloods. Anderson declined to press charges, and he left the casino. The footage still exists. You've probably seen it. Prosecutors intend to play it for the jury as the motive for basically everything that followed. Attack at the MGM, retaliation at Flamingo and Coal Vault, which is where he was shot. Later that night, a white Cadillac pulled up alongside the BMW at that red light near the strip. Someone in the back seat opened fire. Tupac was hit multiple times. Knight was grazed. Tupac was taken to University Medical Center and died 6 days later on September 13th of 1996. For 27 years, nobody was charged. The Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department had names and had theories about the motive. What they didn't have was a case any prosecutor would take to a grand jury. In 2008, Davis sat down with a joint task force that included the LAPD. They were investigating the murder of Christopher Wallace, the notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls, who was shot in Los Angeles just 6 months after Tupac died. A lot of people at the time and still to this day connect the two and say it was retaliation for the murder of Tupac. During those interviews, Davis talked about the Las Vegas shooting. His attorneys later called that arrangement a proffer. And a proffer, it works like this. You sit down with investigators and tell them what you know, and they agree not to use it against you. The task force was not investigating Tupac's murder. They were building a case in Los Angeles. What Davis told them about Las Vegas was extra. Then Davis went public. In 2018, he appeared in a BET documentary and discussed the shooting on camera. He'd been diagnosed with cancer and told interviewers he had nothing left to lose. In 2019, his memoir came out, Compton Street Legend. Prosecutors told the court that Davis discussed his alleged involvement in nearly every form imaginable. They say a book is a different kind of evidence than a police interview. A proffer transcript is a document prosecutors have to explain. They have to tell the jury what deal was on the table and what pressure the man was under. A memoir, they say, works completely differently. He chose the words. He chose when to publish them. His name is on the cover. Prosecutors can read it out loud in court. The book was released through a small publisher and sold openly. Anyone could buy it, including a Las Vegas homicide detective. Grand jury transcripts framed the killing as a gang retaliation tied to a war between two record labels, Death Row Records on one side, aligned with Mob Crew Bloods, Bad Boy Records on the other, aligned with the Southside Compton Crips, which was Davis's crew. Witnesses testified before the grand jury that the Crips provided protection for Bad Boy at events and on the road. The two sides have been in contact for years before that night in Las Vegas. Prosecutors are not arguing that Davis pulled the trigger. Their theory is that he was the shot caller, meaning the person who gives the order. They allege he provided the gun and directed the retaliation from the front passenger seat. A Clark County grand jury indicted Davis in September of 23. Grand juries hear only the prosecution's evidence with no defense case and no cross-examination at that sort of stage. The indictment came 36 days after Las Vegas police executed a search warrant at his Henderson home. That search happened in July of 23, 14 years after they first had his statements. Davis is the only person ever charged in connection with Tupac's death. Everyone else prosecutors have named as either being in the Cadillac is either dead or has never faced a charge. Orlando Anderson was questioned by police in 96 and released without notice. Then he died. Judge Kearney ruled the memoir and the 2008 police recording are admissible. 12 people will sit in that Los Angeles courtroom and listen to Keefe D. Davis describe that night in his own words, read from his own book while he sits at the defense table. That ruling is the case. Without the memoir and the recording, prosecutors are left with a casino fight, a gang rivalry, and no evidence really connecting Davis to the shooting himself. It's his own words that have brought him there, his own misunderstanding or overconfidence in the proffer agreement, not really knowing just how easily that can be used against you. He's a victim of his own foolish stupidity and poor decision-making. After his arrest in September of 23, Davis's account changed. He said, wait a second. That proffer agreement, that information I gave you in the Biggie investigation, that's all a lie. Oh, that book I wrote, that's all a lie. Those interviews I gave, those are all a lie. It's all mythical. It's all I just made it up. He gave an interview to ABC News from jail and said he's innocent. I ain't killed nobody, he told them. He said he only talked about the murder to make a little money. At one point, he claimed he wasn't even in Las Vegas when the shooting happened. It's 30 years ago, so good luck proving either way. His attorneys built the defense around the 2008 proffer. The argument was immunity, meaning a promise to investigators that you won't be charged for what you tell them. Davis said the promise covered him permanently. At least that's what he thought. His attorneys asked Judge Kearney to bar the statements and everything that came from them, and that was, surprise, denied. Prosecutors argued that a proffer agreement in Nevada would have required a judge's sign-off, and no judge ever signed off on anything. They also argued that Davis gave up any protection he thought he had when he spent the next 15 years repeating the same accounts publicly. That's probably the same lever that made him think he could talk publicly, because he talked about it over here, and I guess it's free game now. Turns out it's not. You know where this also went horribly awry? Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby made all sorts of admissions in an agreement, in a deposition, and he thought could not be used against him. Eventually, it was used against him, and he went to prison. And then he went back and sued and said, no, that agreement over here, this is not, that's supposed to be able to be used over there. And actually, he won that one. That's why he's a free predator today. Or man, I mean. Alleged predator, I guess. Oh, I don't know what you call him. Counting down days to die, old man. The defense moved to suppress evidence from a nighttime search of Davis's home. Nighttime searches require extra justification because courts treat them as more intrusive. His attorneys argued investigators used a misleading warrant application. That was denied, too. They moved to dismiss the charges over the 27-year delay between the murder and the indictment. Witnesses die over that span, and memories fail. Physical evidence disappears. Judge Kearney also denied that. Every alibi witness Davis might have called is 30 years harder to find, or dead. And a defendant charged this late is working with fewer tools than he would have had in 1997. Davis has been through three legal teams since his arrest. One withdrew over a retainer dispute. Changing counsel that many times in a capital adjacent case does slow everything down. He also picked up a battery conviction for a fight with another inmate at the Clark County Detention Center. He was sentenced to 16 to 40 months on that one. At the final hearing before trial, Davis told the court he's considering posting his $750,000 bond during the proceedings. Judge Kearney said he could because bond only becomes an issue once a jury reaches a verdict. Las Vegas police had Davis's statements by 09. They had the proffer from the LAPD task force. They knew what he told investigators because it was on a transcript with his name on it. A BET documentary aired in 2018 and reached a national audience. The memoir published in 19 and was available for anyone to buy. And the arrest came in September of 23. 14 years between the statements and the handcuffs. Davis was not hiding during those years. He lived in Henderson, a suburb 15 miles from where Tupac was shot. Gave interviews, appeared on podcasts, promoted the book. He used his real name and the same nickname prosecutors now put in the court filings. Anyone looking for him could have found him. Mopreem Shakur is Tupac's stepbrother. He told the Associated Press that his family has spent 30 years waiting for this. He described the experience as exhausting and stressful. He said sitting through the trial will be re-traumatizing. He also said he's cautiously optimistic that justice will come. And that he hopes the trial was fair. 30 years is long enough that most of the people who could have testified are gone. Suge Knight was driving the car and survived the shooting. He is serving a 28-year sentence in California for an unrelated 2015 killing. He might be a witness at this trial. The defense gets to put that timeline in front of the jury, 14 years of an open case file. Well, the man in it published a book, sat for a documentary, and gave interviews. Prosecutors say the memoir gave them a first-person account they could put in front of jurors in a way a decade-old proffer transcript never could. 12 people in Las Vegas are working with a case that has no murder weapon and no DNA. Orlando Anderson has also been dead since 1998 and cannot be cross-examined by anybody. What the jury gets is surveillance video from the MGM Grand, a grand jury transcript. They get a memoir, a documentary, and police recordings, plus a defendant whose account changed after his arrest. The charge is narrower than it sounds. Prosecutors don't have to prove Davis fired a weapon. They have to prove he gave an order. Presence in the car doesn't get them there. And knowing what was about to happen doesn't either. They have to prove Davis made it happen. The evidence for that comes almost entirely from what Davis said about himself, which is why the admissibility ruling mattered more than any other decision in this case. His attorneys will tell the jury he's a storyteller who sold a version of events for money. They'll argue the memoir is marketing rather than a confession written by a man who needed the sales. Prosecutors will tell a jury a man doesn't describe supplying a murder weapon unless he supplied one. Both sides are working from that same material. That material is a book written by the defendant, and each side needs the jury to read it a different way. Ordinarily, a murder trial is a fight over physical evidence and what it proves. This one is a fight over whether a man was lying when he described himself as guilty. The jury has to decide which of his accounts to credit, with no gun and no shooter to check them against. Most of the jurors seated for this were children or not even born in 1996. They'll evaluate a 30-year-old shooting through a memoir, a documentary, and a courtroom. Brings us back to where the state started. No gun, no DNA, no Orlando Anderson to cross-examine. What the state had is that book and the defendant's name on the cover. And a man at the defense table who says he wrote it for money. Tupac Shakur was 25 years old when someone in a white Cadillac opened fire on him at a red light. He was pronounced dead 6 days later. His mother, Afeni, spent the rest of her life without answers and died in 2016. His stepbrother has spent 30 years waiting for that courtroom. They finally have one. The trial is expected to last about a month, and when it's over, 12 people will decide whether the man who allegedly told the world that he killed Tupac spends the rest of his life in prison for that claim. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. We'll continue our conversation right there. Until next time, I'm Tony Brewski. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.